This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will examine last night's debate as Congressman Bill Cassidy took the stage at Centenary College, along with U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu and Colonel Rob Manus. And 21 days before the election, they tried to make the case that they should be the U.S. Senator for the next 6 years in Louisiana. Scott Wilfong, Republican, and Trey Orso, Democrat, slated to be with us to talk about winners, losers, and otherwise, and where does the campaign go 20 days from Election Day. Also, Dr. Judith Sylvester of LSU, she led the successful fight to make LSU a smoke-free campus. She will talk about how that's going in the first few months. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. Trey Orso, Democrat, and Scott Wilfong, Republican. And we're going to review last night's debate of the three major candidates in the U.S. Senate election, now 20 days away. The incumbent, Democrat Mary Landrieu, and two Republican challengers, Colonel Rob Manus and Congressman Bill Cassidy. Last night was Cassidy's first appearance with the other two candidates. He has been somewhat shy about interacting with his fellow candidates for U.S. Senate, and polls show him in the lead right now, albeit very slight, but still in the lead. And as the Times-Picayune reports this morning, in almost every question, Cassidy mentioned President Obama, who is particularly unpopular in Louisiana. Trey Orso, your thoughts about the strategy and the performance of the man who is trying to unseat Senator Landrieu.
Well, Jim, I mean, it's good morning, and good morning, Scott. I mean, that's what he's been doing the whole election, so it doesn't surprise us that when he finally does decide to show up at a debate, you know, he wants to talk a lot more about President Obama than he does about any plans that he may have. But as we all know, the president is not on the ballot next month. He's on the ballot, and Senator Landrieu's on the ballot, and Rob Manus is on the ballot. So voters here in Louisiana get to choose between those three as opposed to the president. So that's what he needs to do, because thus far he really hadn't had a whole lot to say about himself or his plans or going forward. He just has really been running almost a stealth campaign, and he has one word that he likes to say, and it starts with a no.
Well, Scott Wilfong, it would seem that based on conversations we've had through the years, you might be more comfortable with Rob Manus than with Bill Cassidy, but you are a bean counter, and it looks like Cassidy is the one most likely to make
I think I said the last time I was on the show, you know, that I had been getting a lot of conservative people asking me about Rob Manus, and I said, well, he's a great guy. You know, I just wish you'd asked that question about 9 months ago when something could, you know, when you would have had a chance perhaps to move him to the front. You know, I like both the guys. I've met with both of them, and I'll help both of them. But I do think, you know, I'll agree a little bit with Trey. I have this little fear in the back of my mind that it reminds me a little bit of 2012 when Mitt Romney kind of jumped out and was kind of the early favorite. And then he just kind of sat there and didn't really close the deal, so to speak, in the final two debates. You know, I wouldn't say that Cassidy had this overwhelming victory last night, but I think he's slowly gone from maybe a 50-50 candidate to now where he's probably slightly likely to win the race, you know, somewhere in that 60% range. But I feel like he's afraid to make a mistake, and I'd really like to see him come out and sell himself a little more, you know, and kind of close the deal with the voters.
I think he got Mike Wolf, our Libertarian friend's vote last night, because he's in favor of medicinal marijuana on the record. And Mary Landrieu and Rob Manus are against the evils of marijuana. So, Scott Wilfong, I'm sure you're quite pleased that Congressman Cassidy is in favor of legalization of marijuana.
It's a little bizarre. I don't know. I mean, maybe he really does have that personal view as a physician. You know, I can't speak to that if there's a real medical reason why. But You know, the only thing I can think is maybe there is that, you know, there's those small pockets of votes do count, especially mm-hmm. towards the end. You know, if you can cobble together, you know, a coalition of a few libertarian votes, a few single issue voters on certain things like that, maybe. But I tend to think probably he just, as a physician, feels like it's not harmful or something, or, you know.
Well, back when he was supporting Michael Dukakis and Mary Landrieu and Kathleen Blanco, perhaps he was in some smoke-filled rooms.
What I thought was interesting about that is, if I'm not mistaken, I think they asked him. He was the first to respond on that. And, you know, obviously medicinal marijuana is becoming legal in more and more places. And when he said yes, I really almost thought the other two would fall in line with him on it. So I thought it was interesting that he jumped out there and the others left him hanging, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the real shocker for that from that whole moment is that was like the most amazing point of the debate. It was really such a dull debate that's the thing that sticks out in our mind mm-hmm. is medicinal marijuana, which, you know, I'm not so sure that one U.S. senator can do a whole lot to affect. That's really a state issue anyway.
I remember my friend Pat Simon once asked Mary Landrieu if she'd ever smoked marijuana, and her answer was no.
No.
That's what she said.
Wow.
And I'm sure she would not tell a lie.
She said she lived in New Orleans.
No, well, 297-5633. There were many other issues debated last night, and it was sponsored by Louisiana Public Broadcasting. And I was in a restaurant trying to listen and watch, and I must say I was the only one paying attention. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure in the long run this is going to determine much as far as what goes forward. Now, the big thing that Cassidy avoided, he didn't make a big gaffe that would be played over and over. And
yeah, I think that's what he's afraid of. Just like Mitt Romney, I think, was afraid 2 years ago that he was gonna blow it. But it was a miscalculation. He wasn't really where he thought he was. And you know, I think that Cassidy is, you know, as long as the race goes to a runoff, I think Cassidy, I don't even know if I'd put Trey on the spot, but I think he might even say in a runoff, I think Bill Cassidy is the favorite. I think even objective observers would say that. But, you know, if perhaps Landrieu is stronger than what she's polling, you know, I've always said her best chance to win this race is November 4th. You know, and I have this little fear that maybe she's a lot closer to 50 than we think she is.
Trey,
before we get on that, I do think, besides the answer about smoking pot, to me the biggest whopper of the debate was Cassidy double down and on raising Social Security age to 70. You know, I just don't think that's a popular policy, and he can try and soften it by saying, well, we're going to do it in increments or this, that, and the other. But I think if there was a gaffe, so to speak, in the debate last night, and something that's going to pop up and you'll hear a lot more about over the next 3 weeks, is Cassidy confirming that he wants to raise the age on Social Security.
And Landrieu also noted that Cassidy allegedly sponsored a bill very similar to Obamacare when he was in the Louisiana legislature, and Cassidy really didn't come back and answer those allegations.
Well, he can't, because it's not an allegation. I mean, it's the truth. I mean, he filed a bill when he was a member of the Senate, a health care bill that had many of the elements of Obamacare. I mean, he not only was he for it before he was against it, he authored it before he was against it. And he couldn't rebut that, because it's the absolute truth.
Well, but again, the bill didn't go anywhere either. It died in committee, and you know that.
Well, it doesn't excuse the fact that he was the author for it. I mean, whether it went anywhere or not, he authored a bill mm-hmm. as a state senator in Louisiana that had many similar elements to Obamacare.
Well, I think it does. It does make a difference, though, the fact that he may have had those ideas and put those out there, and they didn't go anywhere. Mary Landrieu voted against the interests of her state and clearly the interest of the country when Obamacare was overwhelmingly mm-hmm. unpopular, and they did not want it passed, and she did it anyway. She cast a vote for the president and not for the people of Louisiana.
Well, Congressman Cassidy has had an epiphany. As we know, he supported Mike Dukakis and Mary Landrieu and Kathleen Blanco. And Blanco, of course, ran in 2003 when the congressman was 46 years old. So he his his conversion has come rather late in life, and he had been flirting with running for office for some time. And Trey, I used to be in the same building with you when you were with the Democratic Party. Did you ever get a visit from the congressman?
You know, I did. Back in the day when I was director of the party, Dr. Cassidy wanted to run for a state Senate seat, which was the old Tom Green seat, which was based on the west side of the river and had a little section that came into East Baton Rouge Parish. And Dr. Cassidy lived in that area and wanted to run, and he came and met with me. I mean, he was a Democrat and, of course, worked at the charity hospital, Earl K. Long. And I tell you, I mean, first of all, I think he's a nice guy, the little I know of him, but we really liked him. I mean, he came in and we were like, this guy is a true believer, Democrat. But I'll be honest with you, I discouraged him as director of the state party for running for that Senate seat because a person from East Baton Rouge Parish was just not going to win that race because the district at the time was based so much on the west side of the river. But we really were excited about him and told him that we would hope to find another seat that he could run for because we just thought he was such a strong Democrat and would make such a great candidate. That was in 1998 or 99 or whatever the year was. But, yeah, I mean, that's a true story.
All right. 2975633. Scott's shaking his head.
Why didn't you tell me that earlier, Trey?
Well, I mean, it's the truth. I mean, look, I mean, I think that's part of the problem that Cassidy's had the whole time. He says all the things that a Republican is supposed to say today, but the reason that Rob Manis is getting anywhere from 10 to 15% in all the polls that you see, and the reason that Bill Cassidy has not been able to run away with this thing in a state that supposedly is so red with an unpopular president, is because a lot of folks on the other side, when I say the other side, I mean the true blue Republicans, they really don't think he's the real deal. I mean, they know his past, they know his history, they know what his beliefs were, they know he supported Dukakis, they know he wrote letters to the editor bashing Reagan and military spending. They know these things about Bill Cassidy. And so Bill Cassidy, by all accounts, should be running away with this thing. But the fact that Mary Landrieu is still leading the race and still tied in a heads-up race, statistically tied in all these polls, it just shows that Cassidy is a flawed candidate kind of from both sides.
Well, but you're right, Trey, in some of that. But the fact is that voters are sophisticated enough to look at his record and say, you know, even myself personally, whatever he may personally believe, his record in Congress bears out that he will vote the way conservatives want.
All right, Jim on airline. Jim's been waiting patiently. Good morning. You're on the air with Trey and Scott.
Good morning, Jim. I would appreciate an opportunity to use about three sentences instead of one. I think that the whole crux of the problem in the country, of course, is employment, but not only employment, but livable employment. Nobody is willing to state outright that the middle class was created out of unionism, collective bargaining, and the right to strike. The solution, I believe, is to take the people who went offshore and to preclude them from the markets. In that way, the labor markets, if we gave labor back the right to collective bargaining and strike, they could extract from industry their fair share of the wealth.
All right, that was not one of the
Jimmy Hoffa to restore the country, I guess. Huh?
Well, it's apparent the two candidates, for example, have differences. The two major candidates have differences on the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
You're with Congressman Cassidy on this one, Scott?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the minimum wage is this red herring that Democrats love to throw out there, and somehow we're going to improve the middle class if we raise the minimum wage 50 cents an hour. The minimum wage is not intended to be a middle class wage. If you want to raise the minimum wage, then you raise expenses across the board for all businesses, and you increase costs and you cost jobs. I mean, you know, it's such a silly argument, but it's just funny that the Democrats continue to latch onto it over and over and over again.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We'll return to the phone lines with Democrat Trey Orso and Republican Scott Wilfong as we are 20 days away from the U.S. Senate election, and the first debate with Congressman Cassidy was last night. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Scott Wilfong and Trey Orso on opposite sides of the political spectrum reviewing last night's debate, two Republicans against one Democrat, but the one Democrat is of course, the incumbent, Mary Landrieu, who's been down this road before. In 2002, she beat three Republicans of note, and Susie Terrell, Tony Perkins, and John Cooksey. And at that time, one of her most ardent supporters was a guy named William Morgan Cassidy, who is now her principal challenger. 297-5633, Chuck in Lafayette, you're on the air, Chuck.
Good morning, gentlemen. I watched the debate in its entirety, and I was struck by two things with Congressman Cassidy. One was how he kept going back to Obama rather than addressing the actual benefit that Mary Landrieu has brought to Louisiana. And the second was he struck a striking resemblance, in my mind, to Nixon. His hand gestures, his facial tics, and the omissions that he left out in terms of what he said. That was my takeaway from it.
Well, he did mention Obama over and over and over again, but, you know, I think you have to at least give him credit. That is his major point, is he's trying to tell the voters and remind them that if you like Obama, Landrieu's your girl. She's with him 98% of the time.
But it was 97.
Whatever it is. but I mean, that is a valid point to make in your campaign. You have a president.
But Obama's not running for re-election.
But he's still going to be president for two more years, at least. We hope only two, but... She's going to be if she's reelected, she'll be in the Senate and she'll be voting with him 97% of the time. That's a valid political argument to make. Do you want her there casting her vote every time with Obama, or do you not? I think it's a good point. It's great.
Well, I don't think we would have expected Dr. Cassidy to talk about all the great things Mary's done for the state since she's been in the Senate, but I don't think that her record can be denied when you start looking at the projects she's brought back. Military funding, coastal funding, hospitals. I mean, she has done a great job for Louisiana and Washington, and it's a lot to do because of her seniority. She's chair of the Energy Committee. That's why you find a lot of people down along the coast in oil and gas country that traditionally may not be for a Democrat in a federal race, but they're supporting her in this race because they recognize that in Washington, D.C., seniority counts for a lot, and we're lucky to have her there.
Well, then her argument is let's ever turn out a senior senator because seniority is all that matters.
Hey, Scott, I don't see Bill Cassidy saying elect me this time and I'll only serve 6 years or 12 years. I mean, he's been running for office for quite a while now trying to move himself up the chain. So it's not like he can run as an outsider, like he's not a politician. I mean, he's a member of Congress. He was a member of the state Senate. He's got a voting record, too. If Cassidy starts making an argument, yeah, elect me and I'll only serve a term or two, well, then okay.
Well, I'm not faulting her for not term limiting herself. What I'm saying is there anything she's done, really, that any other senator from Louisiana couldn't have done? I mean, David Vitter brings home funding, too. David Vitter does a lot of things. I don't necessarily credit them for that. I expect
that. Everybody recognizes Mary Landrieu has been a leader on coastal funds,
all right,
hurricane recovery funds. I mean, that's undeniable. She is... done yeoman's work.
All right, Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Trey and Scott.
Yes, would you agree that if you viewed any of the other debates on C-SPAN where you had a Democratic incumbent and a Republican challenger, that they essentially say the same thing, parroting the Republican talking points?
Probably so. I'd say 80% of it would be the same. I mean, mm-hmm. There are certain state issues. Trey just mentioned coastal erosion and certain issues specific to Louisiana, oil and gas, things like that. If you were in the Midwest, you might be talking about farm subsidies and things like that. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's become a kind of a trend nationally. There's Democrat talking mm-hmm. points, Republican talking points.
All right.
Go ahead,
Trey.
I'd like to address that. This year, probably 80% of my work is outside of Louisiana. Most of my work is in Maine, Missouri, and Kansas, a pretty Democratic state, typical swing state and a pretty Republican state. And I can confirm what that gentleman just said. I don't care what district in a state legislative race, in a congressional race, what district, what state, urban, rural, country, coastal, you know, Kansas wheat fields, they say one thing, Obama. I mean, that's all they have to say. I mean, Obama. It's ridiculous. They're not talking, the Republicans around the country are not talking about any issues that matter to families, education, health care, job creation. I mean, they talk about one thing.
Stephanie asks how the two of you think the three candidates handled the global warming question.
I thought Mr. Cassidy, when he said that the temperatures aren't rising, just sounded like he was way out of touch with science.
Well, the science I've read has said that we're in a 15-year pattern of no increase in global temperatures. So, I think that,
I don't think anybody can deny. I mean, the science is clear.
But you see, that's the Democrat.
Getting warmer.
That's
so
the Democrat answer every time. No one can deny it except people do deny it. If you read the scientific journals, if you read the Wall Street Journal, there's articles every week about science that denies global warming. But what do the Democrats say? Oh, well, no one can deny it. Well, let me just say, Scott Wilfong today, I can deny it with science and articles and research that other people have done.
We're going to put you and Dr. Cassidy in the Head in the Sand Club, and y'all sit over there and deny it as the oceans get higher and the ice melts and the temperature rises, and just go ahead and keep denying it.
Coldest winter in 20 years we just had in Baton Rouge.
Paul, global warming. Baton Rouge. Paul on the north.
Right, but it was the warmest winter we've had globally.
All right, Paul on the North Shore.
I want to follow up where a previous caller mentioned. I was distracted and then amused by Cassidy's hand gestures. They were so obviously carefully rehearsed that they were done in such an awkward and amateurish way that I was kind of fascinated by them.
Well, he's a surgeon. He's ready to get a scalpel,
Is he a surgeon or just...
Yes, he's a liver doctor. His wife, of course, was a very good surgeon, and Dr. Cassidy's been known to... in fact, he offered me a liver biopsy on the house once.
Oh, my God. There's a serious part to this question. I'm glad it was asked, because this, when you go back to what the founding fathers intended for this country, senators were not elected by the people. And I'm not criticizing the caller. Don't take this the wrong way. But when we're worried about how a man's hand gestures come across as to whether we should put them in the U.S. Senate, I think that reflects the
capriciousness. Well, what about Al Gore's sighing? Al Gore lost the presidential election because he sighed too much in a debate.
People can say that. People can argue that. And guess what? The president's not elected by a direct vote of the people either. That was the intent of the founding fathers. They were wise enough to know that people are so capricious, they will vote for or against people based on anything. They won't demand them to actually hold them to account. They'll worry about how their hair looks or their hands look.
I think the broader part of the question is just that, he just... And I think it has a lot to do, Jim, with why he has not accepted all the debate invitations, why he doesn't go to a lot of unplanned public-type events and just mingle much, because he can come across with an awkward demeanor. And I'm sure his handlers recognize that, and that's why he doesn't do a lot of public events. He doesn't do a lot of live debate forums. Most everything he does on the campaign trail is orchestrated and canned, and controlled, and I think that has, and they recognize nothing against him. I mean, different people handle themselves differently, but I think that has a lot to do with why they have campaigned the way they have.
Thank you, Paul. Doug on Segan. Hi, Doug. You're on with Trey and with Scott.
Yes. Good morning. Just on a factual basis, something that keeps coming up: the Affordable Care Act does not cut Medicare benefits. It does achieve $700 billion cost controls over the next decade, but those are not cuts in benefits. And the end result of that is that the trust fund for Medicare's solvency has been extended to 2030, which would seem to be a good thing. But the attack that keeps being made on it is that it cut benefits, because obviously that scares seniors into thinking their benefits are being cut. So all this is available to anyone who wants to try to look it up, but I continue to be just kind of appalled at how things are said that have repeatedly been shown not to be the case.
Well, you know what scares seniors is when their doctor refuses to accept Medicare anymore and they have to go find another doctor, because doctors are, believe it or not, even the liberal ones are capitalists, and they're in the business to make money. So when you cut $700 billion out of a program that pays physicians to take care of people, and then you think somehow magically that money will reappear on the other side of the country and go right into the doctor's pockets and everything will be fine, that's naivety at its highest. So I appreciate the comment, but the fact is what scares seniors is when they can't go see their doctor anymore because they don't take Medicare.
Right. Well, there will apparently be one more debate where Congressman Cassidy is involved, and that's October 29th, and WRKF is one of the sponsors of that debate at the LSU Journalism School. The question, I think, is whether if he gets in a runoff, he'll debate Senator Landrieu one, two, or three times between November the 4th and December the 6th.
He shouldn't debate her at all if he's in a runoff.
You don't think so?
Absolutely not. That's when you mail it in, when you send home. She's toast.
So she was in the runoff with Susie Terrell, and she debated her on Meet the Press.
The only exception would be if the Senate is tied and Louisiana is the final vote that will determine control.
I think it would be a huge show of weakness if they're in a runoff and he decides not to debate. I mean, you cannot hide in a hole to be a United States senator. I mean, you have to come out and answer questions. If you're not competent enough and confident enough in your own ability to do an hour debate on the issues that you have been talking about all year, when you want to be United States senator, you really would not be worthy of the job.
That's a great point. I don't disagree with you. But who would be left to convince at that point, Trey? Well, who's undecided in December?
Well, I don't know. You might have 15%. For Manus, those people go, and then
where do those votes go? Where do Manus's votes go?
I think a majority of them would go to Cassidy, but I think a portion of them would go to Landrieu, and I think a portion of them would not go anywhere. They'd go to the hunting camp.
I mean, if Landrieu just assume, you know, pick a number, say she gets 44% in November, how does she even get back to that 44? How does she return that electorate to the polls in
December?
Well,
she did in 2002. It was identical.
A little different situation, a different state. Pre-Katrina, you had about 40,000 more black votes in Louisiana at that time, the majority of which went for Landrieu. You're talking about a race where 20,000, 30,000 votes difference is what will determine.
Let me just say that the same people that vote on November 4th is not the same electorate on the 6th. I mean, you have a lot of them that vote again. You have some people that will go once and they won't go again. Then you have some people that will show up in December that weren't there in November. I mean, it's a fluid electorate.
Okay, Michael and Hammond. Michael, you're on with Trey and with Scott.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was wanting to ask a follow-up question about the minimum wage increase. I have heard both sides of the debate, and it appears that we don't address one of the main issues in that when people are coming onto a job, having a very high wage when they first get there is very difficult for employers to take on the risk of hiring a new person. But if they can bring them in at a lower level and then say after 1 year of being steady, faithful to a job, then that person is eligible for a minimum wage. That seems like something I've just never heard, but it seems to be something that is worthwhile, and I wonder why we don't hear that in the debate. Is that built into the process?
All right, Trey.
Jim, I didn't get to address this because we went to a commercial earlier, but I'm pretty sure the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Scott was saying, well, it shouldn't be a middle class wage; it should be a minimum wage. Well, if you work 40 hours a week, that's $290 a week. If you work full time at minimum wage, 52 weeks a year, that's $15,080. I don't think anybody would believe for a second that somebody that works full-time, this is not somebody looking for a handout, somebody looking for a hand up, full-time for $15,000 a year, I don't think that would qualify you as a middle class. The argument that raising the minimum wage to give people a living wage would ruin the economy is a joke. Every time they raise the minimum wage, the Republicans yell, oh, my God, you're going to kill jobs. You're going to kill the economy. And guess what? The economy keeps growing. It keeps getting bigger. They raised it during Clinton's time when he was president, and that was the strongest stretch we've had in my lifetime. So,
well, so let's
the
take
the fact that somebody, the fact that you want to sit here, or anybody wants to sit here and say, oh, $7.25 an hour working full time offers somebody a middle class lifestyle, and that just doesn't even hold water.
But are you arguing then that we should make the minimum wage a middle class wage? Because we
no.
can say we raise it 30%. Okay,
no,
that's
Scott,
$9 an hour. Is $18,000 a year going to be a living wage?
Scott, I'm arguing that when you're paying somebody $7.25 an hour who works full time, you're going to be paying elsewhere too for different social services and other programs that we're going to have to provide for them, because human beings in 2014 can't live and raise a family on $15,000 a year.
And they
so
can't raise it on $18,000.
It makes sense for all your business owner, businessmen, friend to have consumers out there that actually have a couple dollars in their pocket to buy a loaf of bread and to pay the light bill instead of having to get a handout all the time, even though they're working full time.
But Trey, if you doubled it, that's $30,000 a year.
I'm not arguing
that's
to
not middle class.
Right, but I'm not even arguing to double it. I'm saying that the argument that giving people more than $7.25 an hour to work full time is an abomination.
Well, all how right. about we ask that they earn their way?
HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on with Scott and Trey.
Good morning, gentlemen. The last I've heard in recent years is that Congress's approval rating is at an all-time low with no balanced budget in the last 4 years for sure. The question is, does this help or hurt either candidate, and is the American people have a tendency now to go more for term limits against the career politician? Thank you.
You know, I mean, I've always said there we've had term limits as long as this nation's been around. It's called the ballot box. And, you know, while Congress's approval rating's at an all-time low, I'm going to throw a number out there, but I'm going to guess it's somewhere around 85% of all members of Congress will be reelected
more
this year.
More than that.
More
probably.
Than
yeah,
that.
It's probably
so,
more than
you know, I there's a point where, you know, I love my fellow Americans, but I really can't help you anymore. When you keep doing the same thing and you keep returning the same people to Congress, you have an opportunity to turn them out every 2 years, and in the Senate every 6 years.
Well, in Louisiana, we had a U.S. Senator, David Vitter, who survived a prostitution scandal. Trey, you said you were working a campaign in Kansas, and I had a caller ask about the governor's race there.
Yeah.
A guy, 42 years old, who went to a strip club when he was a single man at 26. He's in trouble now because of that.
Well, actually, his name is Paul Davis. He's not in trouble. He's leading Sam Brownback by about 5 points in all the polls. Brownback and them have tried to make a big deal out of it, but Paul was at a whatever strip club, whatever you call it, when he was single and 20-something years old, and that is the truth.
Wow. Is it the governor's race?
Yeah, the governor's race.
Okay. Yeah,
he's
going to
beat Sam Brownback, and then Roberts is in trouble there. They have an independent named Orman.
Yeah, I know that independent
really
who's got George Soros campaigning for him. That,
really,
that's a real
but
independent.
But could a candidate in Louisiana survive going to a strip club, Scott?
I think they have. I think we had a four-term governor that did things.
I don't think he went to a strip club.
I think the image that voters
well, they
had
can survive
him.
Prostitutes. They can probably survive.
Yeah, they
a
could.
Strip
they
club.
Could. They could.
Well, sometimes we give candidates a break on illegal activity, but you better not be caught in an adult establishment. That could be political suicide. It happened, by the way, to our frequent guest in California, of all places. Bruce Hershenson, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Trey Orso and Scott Wilfong. Rinaldi in Sherwood. Rinaldi, good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. As a business owner here in Baton Rouge, I don't mind paying somebody a working wage of, say, $9 an hour. Because if we don't, we'll never raise the standards for people in the community. Now, I'm going to call myself a capitalist Democrat. I'm one who believes that strongly in business. But also understand that, hey, as a worker and having been in this system, you have to earn a wage for your family. Now, both of my sons stay here in Louisiana. They work here in Louisiana, and they're going to invest here in Louisiana. And we just need to stop all the rhetoric around the working wage that people actually need. There are many business owners, hey, we want workers to have a decent wage so they can buy decent things. And you know, all I can say is, hey, I'm with Mary this time, and I'm going to stick with Mary. And I think people are underestimating the black vote. And Jim, if I could just touch on one thing about Republicans and the gerrymandering of elections, if I could. The reason Republicans have continued to hold on to the House is simply because of the incumbency that they placed through the process of drawing the maps. Now,
all right.
I'm glad to hear that. In fact, I challenged the caller to pay his workers $10 an hour, $12 an hour. Go as high as you can. Just don't tell me I have to do it. That's where I have a problem. When I make decisions to run my business and I pay taxes based on that, you pay your guys what you want, and I pay them what I can afford. And I have no problem with a minimum wage, but when you start talking about we need to give them enough so that it's a living wage, like our discussion with Trey and myself earlier, if we doubled it, that's $30,000 a year. That's hardly a living wage in America anymore.
And as far as the gerrymandering or alleged gerrymandering mentioned by Rinaldi, Trey, I see the Daily Reveille today has a very nice piece on the 6th District race, which now has just 22% African-American representation. Right. When Marjorie McKithen nearly won that seat, 16 years ago, it was over 30%.
Yep.
Edwin Edwards would have a fighting shot, I think, if it were over 30%. But now it's going to be very difficult for any Democrat, Edwards or anybody else, to win in the 6th District.
Yeah, I mean, they drew that seat to protect Cassidy, basically, and protect a Republican seat. I mean, it's one of the top 20 or 30 most Republican districts in the country right now based on partisan performance. So any Democrat, Governor Edwards or anybody else, it's a tough district.
Well, what percent black is the second district? How many whites are in Cedric Richmond's district?
Well,
about the same number, right?
No, the second district's over. It's even more African American.
Yeah, it might be 60-something%.
But it was also a way to protect the second district from somebody like Joseph Gow winning again.
Right. That's right.
Well, they brought the second district all the way up here to Baton Rouge,
Iowa Street. Yeah, you can throw a stone from Bill Cassidy's house at 3115 Dalrymple into the second district.
Our East Baton Rouge Republican chairman lives in the second district.
There you go.
Woody Jenkins.
Chuck, he does. Chuck
Jim, maybe Governor Edwards should have run for the fifth.
He should have. Chuck on Jefferson. Chuck, good morning. Please be brief.
It's Charles, and the whole thing about the minimum wage, no matter what side you're on, it's what you do with the money you make. I made 95 cents an hour in college. You delay gratification and you build for the future. And so, you know, the whole idea of what you make is not the issue, is what you do with it.
Hear, hear.
Jim, I want to ask this delayed gratification that gentleman just said. Mr. Cassidy was quoted in the paper the other day talking about he's a good Republican because he's for delayed gratification. Scott, what are y'all talking about?
Well, I think, I think you have to look at a bigger picture. You know, in America, the poor people are overweight. One of our biggest problems is the kids watch too much television in the areas that are impoverished. So, you know, everybody gets a free cell phone. Thank your Obama phone. So I think that's what we're talking about is if you want to actually earn something, then you put the money aside and you save until you can earn it. What we have today is a government that just says, oh, you shouldn't have to earn it. We'll just give it to you.
Well, a listener says that Cassidy's delayed gratification is waiting until you get sick so you can use marijuana.
I'm pretty sure kids in all neighborhoods, whether they're impoverished or not, watch a lot of TV. I think that's you need to find another argument. If that's what delayed gratification means, kids.
Obesity
TV,
is the number one health issue among poor people in America. I think that
is probably the
problem.
Number one health issue among rich people, too.
So does delayed gratification mean you shouldn't eat as much? Well, I still don't quite get where y'all are coming with that.
I think what it means is that people should work for what they have and earn it instead of having government give it to them, which is the policies that Mary and Obama and other Democrats are favoring today.
That's just silly.
All right. Charlotte in Iberia, good morning. Please be brief. You're on with Scott and Trey.
Good morning. I'm calling because I believe that the disparity between the CEO pay and their hourly pay is what has caused the lower income or working class people to fall far behind, and that delayed gratification doesn't take place at the executive level.
Okay, well, let's go to Ed on Highland, and you'll be our final caller today for Trey and Scott. Hi, Ed. Good morning.
Yes, Jim. Back to the matter of Senator Landrieu's influence in the Senate, yes, as the current chair of the Energy Committee. If, as is expected, the Senate goes to the Republicans, then she will no longer be chair of the Energy Committee, and that clout that is currently being promoted won't be there.
All right, that's a good point. Trey, if the Democrats lose the Senate, David Vitter might be chair of the Energy Committee.
For a chair, so would he then vacate that seniority and chair to come back and deal with levy boards and state budgets is my question.
Well, I think that what you wouldn't have would be a senator that would vote 98% of the time with a president who is about 30% popularity in this state. So that's what it comes down to. If you want a rubber stamp for Obama for the next 2 years, Mary's your girl.
Who are you going to vote for, Scott?
I will leave that between me and the Lord.
All right, now you're going to be like the lady in Kentucky. Come on, tell us.
That's right, the Democrat who won't admit to voting for...
You can say you're voting for Manus. Come on, Scott. You can say you're voting for Manus. Let's hear it.
I have endorsed Bill Cassidy.
But who are you voting for?
I have about 2 more weeks to make that decision.
Fair enough.
All right. Trey, I think we know who you're voting for.
No doubt.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
Do it again. 297-5633, and we go from legalized medicinal marijuana, which Congressman Cassidy supports, to illegal use of marijuana and every other kind of tobacco on the Louisiana State University campus. There was Mary Landrieu before a football game, reveling with students and getting involved in a keg party, but they can't smoke, and it's all because of one lady, Dr. Judith Sylvester. Good morning, Dr. Sylvester.
Good morning, Jim. It's not just because of me.
you led the charge, then.
Well, I was the squeaky wheel.
How's it going?
I think it's going extremely well. We, of course, you know, it's not 100% by any means yet, and I always say to anybody that I talk to that it is it's a process. And so we're moving along with that process. But we have gotten rid of the receptacles on the LSU campus, and signage is up. We don't have all that we need yet, but we're working on that. We've been making a concerted effort to make sure that everyone knows about it. And you know, we always worry about the football games, but that's really also an in-progress thing. And actually, 3 of the 4 have been really good, and the only one that was kind of tough was the Mississippi State game the first SEC game that we had on
that
campus.
Was Mississippi State.
Yeah, okay. And and then we had 103,000 people on our campus, and if the percentages hold right, about 19,000 of them were smokers. So we had a little trouble that day, but by and large, I think we're making great progress with letting people understand that we are completely 100% tobacco free, and we're going to emphasize that this Saturday with the Kentucky game, because the University of Kentucky has served as our role model, and they've been tobacco free since 2009. And my Fresh Campus student group is going to give a little award to Kentucky for
all right,
leadership.
And in a moment,
area.
We'll be hearing from Dr. Ellen Hahn from the University of Kentucky. But you say that 19,000 people on the average are probably smokers who are unable to smoke, or at least they shouldn't, based on the rules. What happens when they do smoke?
Well, right now we're just approaching them if we see them on campus, and letting them know that we are tobacco free, and asking them to please take their smoking off campus if they can't make it through the day. We also are definitely encouraging people to make strategies. There's plenty of smoking cessation aids that are legal that can be used on campus, like the chewing gum and nicotine gum in patches and things like that. If they need those things to get through the day, then that's great. But mostly we're appealing to their better nature and saying this is our policy, and we want to create a tobacco-free generation coming up, and we need everybody to comply with this and assist with this, because the truth of the matter is We have 443,000 people who die every year in the U.S. from tobacco. Mm-hmm. That's more than the population of New Orleans.
All right. Well, Dr. Hahn is with the University of Kentucky and the Wildcats with a 5-1 record in Vade Tiger Stadium, and it is a no-smoking zone. Kentucky did this before LSU?
2009,
so it's been 5 years. How's it going in Lexington, Dr. Hahn?
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Judith. I'm happy to join you. It's going great, actually. It's been 5 years. We're celebrating our five-year anniversary, November 20th of this year. You know, it's a process. You know, LSU just went, in August? And so, you know, this is it's a process. And, you know, because we have such turnover with students every 4 years, you know, you have to keep up the messaging and the expectation. And, you know, I want to applaud LSU because you did what we call the gold standard, which is similar to what we do, and that is we cover all tobacco products 24/7. And really the reason that campuses do it, you know, this is a mainstream thing now across the country. 975 colleges and universities have 100% tobacco-free policies like LSU's and UK's. So we're not the first. We won't be the last. And we've learned from each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, Judith, Sylvester, are you actually going out there personally and asking people to refrain from smoking?
We have these little push cards.
Yeah.
And yes, if I see somebody, I ask them to. And to quit. Now, I'm not like running around and making a big issue out of it, but I definitely try to inform people as I run into them, and especially students. I mean, I really am focusing on the students, mm-hmm. because the truth of the matter is we've had a couple of events on campus, and I've had lots of students come up and thank us for doing this because they're able to breathe now. They're able to go to the library. And and they'll say that, but they're also very reluctant to ask their peers to not smoke. And so what we really are trying to do is mobilize the students to, you know, just make it the norm. It is the norm, and it always has been, but now it's 100% the norm. So we really are trying very hard to get students activated in this. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, really and truly, the response to me has personally mm-hmm. has been very overwhelming that it's a good thing for us to do.
I predicted there would be confrontations, altercations.
No.
Not one
that I've heard about.
Well, people... they take this seriously, and especially tailgaters who are custom. And I must say, despite the prohibition, when I walk on that campus on Sunday morning sometimes of recent vintage, I still see cigarette butts.
Sure. And that's going to be my next target, really, is raising awareness about the environmental issues with this. And, I mean, I just can't emphasize enough that we didn't expect 100% compliance on day one, and I think we've made remarkable progress. And the main thing is everybody just needs to know we're serious about it, that we do expect people to abide by our policy, and that includes visitors. But at the same time, we understand that an addiction is an addiction, and there are still going to be people who are going to not comply.
Mm-hmm. And Ellen, Kentucky, that's a big part of the economy where you are, isn't it? Tobacco?
Well, actually, tobacco growing traditionally over the years has certainly been a part of our gross state product. It's a very small percent, Jim. It's about less than 1% of our gross state product is from growing tobacco. But having said that, we still are the second leading burley tobacco producer in the country behind North Carolina. And we do have high smoking rates, and so. But I guess I would say if we can do it in Kentucky, you can do it just about anywhere with tobacco-free policy because we have a higher proportion of people who are using tobacco in Kentucky. So it's been a challenge. You know, I always use the analogy of seatbelt laws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most places have seatbelt laws, but, you know, for the past 20 years, there's still plenty of people that don't wear their seatbelts. Do we want them to wear their seatbelts? Yes. Are there consequences if you don't have your seatbelt on? Yes. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, as Judith said, you adopt these policies on the campus. You ask people to respect others and the policy, but the mm-hmm. reality is, I don't know anywhere.
Well, we're short on time, but I have a question from a listener. It does involve smokeless tobacco, doesn't it?
It does. Yes, it does.
And
it includes.
It includes. And anything. Mm-hmm. The electronic?
Yep, e-cigarettes too, because e-cigarettes are not approved by the FDA as a smoking cessation device, and our policy prohibits the use of any vaporizing product that isn't.
This would include medicinal marijuana as well, despite the support from Congressman Bill Cassidy.
Well, marijuana has been outlawed for a long time on our campus. Really? That's nothing new.
Thank you. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.